Dear Heavenly Father, as we approach Thee again, we come with a sense of our complete inability to generate any truth or knowledge, and that all truth and light comes from Thee. We thank Thee for helping us to recognize our dependence and the source of the material that we have, even that comes through our diligent effort and our persistent application of ourselves to projects of experimentation. Even these have come from Thine abundant storehouse. And now, as we study these subjects, we pray that Thy Spirit will be our teacher, will help us to comprehend the interactions of so many things in our lives that influence our health and our usefulness in Thy kingdom. We dedicate ourselves to Thee and pray for Thy presence with us this afternoon. In Jesus' name, amen. I would like us to consider this topic this afternoon as being one of importance to us. It has to do with accelerated aging. It is that thing of depressing our ability to live fully. And so while we can think of something as accelerated aging, we can also think of this topic as being something that contracts the life if we have it. It makes it so that the abilities that God has given us, that these abilities have less expression during the time that we are expressing them, and less length of time, a lessened span of time during which we can express those talents which God has given us. And so that subject that we will be covering today is one that, without any doubt, we must find of great interest to us for the sake of prolonging and enlarging the useful period of our lives. And I'd like to start first with some information on page 482 of Counsels on Diet and Foods. I really like this little book. It is packed full of very valuable information. The first part of this little book has some sections on spirituality and diet. And I'd like to read something that comes from the middle portion of this book. It reads like this on page 168, CD 168. Not in a single instance should the walls of self-restriction be broken down. Not in a single instance. There have been times when I have been tempted to eat something wrong or to eat something too much, a third or fourth helping when a second would have been ample. And I don't recall a single time that I've ever had that temptation, that within 30 minutes or at least within an hour or two, I have discovered some important thing that I didn't know was in my program that came up, that if I had been intoxicated from having eaten that extra amount, I would not have been as well able of mind to take care of that problem. I believe that Satan, who knows our schedules far better than we do, that he has a computerized account of everything that could possibly be served to you at a meal, and just what your schedules are likely to be, and then he tries to put those together in such a way as to make it more likely that you would be an inferior person when you have to deal with certain very important things. To give you an example, let's say a church board is meeting about an important topic of church business. And you go having overeaten or indulged in wrong foods so that you have a sour stomach or an irritated stomach or a clouded mind because of the great variety of things that you have eaten or the wrong foods that you have eaten. And instead of saying, "I," you vote "nay." And the board does not make the proper decision. Years may pass, or you may never know of the evil that you have done, but it is done anyway. You may even maintain that you had done the right thing, because at a later time, when you review the thing in your mind, you may really think that you did the right thing. And yet it was the wrong thing in God's sight. I remember a quote that goes something like this. Many a church trial. No, it goes like this. The dinner table of the parishioners is a fruitful source of church trials. That may not be an exact quote. Fruitful source of church trials. Now, let me read something to you from page 482 of Counsels on Diet and Foods. This was written by Ellen White. "I have thought for years that I was dependent upon a meat diet for strength. I have eaten 3 meals a day until within the last few months." Now, those of you who are familiar with Ellen White, you know that she was a diminutive little lady of a little under 5 feet, probably, and was very frail in health all of her life, especially in the earlier part of her life. And throughout her lifetime, her health continually improved. But at the time that she was writing this, which was in 1864, at which time she would have been how old? A little under 40, wouldn't she? And at that time, she was not in good health at all. And she thought that she was dependent on meat for, what was that?
Strength.
For strength. Dependent on meat for strength. I cannot count the number of people who have told me that they are dependent on meat for strength. But let's listen to the rest of what Ellen White had to say about her experience. "It has been difficult for me to go from one meal to another without suffering from faintness at the stomach and dizziness of the head. Eating would remove these feelings. I seldom allowed myself to eat anything between my regular meals, and I have made it a practice to often retire without supper. But I have suffered greatly for want of food from breakfast to dinner, and have frequently fainted." And that was a fact, that she would often faint and be unconscious for a minute or two. Women used to faint more than they do now, and I'm glad that they don't faint so much anymore. But when I was a child, I can recall that women fainted a lot, and I remember seeing ladies faint at church or faint downtown.
It's just,
oh yes, no, no, they fainted. They were really out. No, it was feminine, but it was very real. Yes. Some people may have learned how to swoon as for drama, but that should more properly be called a swoon. But women really fainted, and Ellen White really fainted. She said, "Eating meat removed for the time these faint feelings. Therefore, I decided that meat was indispensable in my case." But since the Lord presented before me in June 1863 the subject of meat eating in relation to health, I have left off the use of meat. For a while, it was rather difficult to bring my appetite to bread, for which formerly I had but little relish. But by persevering, I have been able to do this. I have lived for nearly a year without meat. For about 6 months, most of the bread upon our table has been unleavened cakes made of unbolted wheat meal and water and a very little salt. By the way, that's a very good recipe. If you take freshly ground wheat and mix it with water, you may put a very little salt, but you will find that it's not essential even to put salt in. Bake them very nicely. Make them up into a dough just about the size of a large walnut, just so they won't fall through the rack in your oven, and lay them right on the rack. You don't have to even grease the rack any. Let them cook until they are browned nicely with an even heat all through the cooking period. They're sweet and tender. Then if you want something that's very different from that, take one of those little walnut-sized balls, put it on a floured board, and roll it out until it's about 8 to 10 inches in diameter, and lay that right on a flat, hot surface in the oven, very hot surface, maybe as high as the oven will go. And about 3 to 5 minutes later, you will take out a huge football that we call waffle bread. No, let's see, ruffle bread. It has a big pocket in it, big pocket of air in the mid portions. Very interesting looking. You serve this great huge basket of this unusual looking bread that's crisp and cracks. Very interesting, and we have found it not only entertaining, but also quite delightful. And that was what Ellen White used on her table, maybe not the football types, but the other kind. She says, "But by persevering, I have been able to do this. I have lived for nearly a year without meat. We use fruits and vegetables liberally. I have lived for 8 months upon 2 meals a day. I have applied myself to writing most of the time for above a year. For 8 months have been confined closely to my writing. My brain has been constantly taxed, and I have had but little exercise. Yet my health has never been better for the past 6 months than for the past 6 months. My former faint and dizzy feelings have left me. I have been troubled every spring with loss of appetite. The last spring, I had no trouble in this respect. Our plain food, eaten twice a day, is enjoyed with..." Do you suppose she really hated her food? She didn't say so. She said, "with keen relish." With keen relish. And I believe that. "Our plain food, eaten twice a day, is enjoyed with a keen relish. We have no meat, no cake, or any rich food upon our table. We use no lard, but in its place milk, cream, and some butter. We have our food prepared with but little salt and have dispensed with all spices. We breakfast at 7 and take our dinner at 1. It is seldom I have a faint feeling. My appetite is satisfied. My food is eaten with greater relish than ever before." For how many of you is this an experience that after you have made a diet reform, you have found that the simple food you eat with much greater relish than before? Is that the experience of practically everyone? Certainly that has been my experience. I remember the sated, jaded appetites that we used to have. Just could hardly be satisfied with anything. And there were things that we would eat that we would enjoy. Oh, this is good. But most of the time, we were just looking for something. We were at unrest all the time. Just what do I want to eat? And just couldn't think of anything really that you would like to eat. Oh, we've had that so much. I just don't want that again. I can't face a this or a that. But I never have that now. And I believe that I could eat the same meal over and over and over again. We never do get to do that, but I think that I could. And sometimes I say to our cook, can't you serve this again another day? Maybe I won't have eaten all that I want of it one day, all that I would like to eat of it on one day. And she doesn't like to serve the same thing two meals. So I chide her a little bit. Can't you just give us this again, just like it is, just like this? Now notice this. This is page 483. I have not changed my course a particle since I adopted the health reform. Now she wrote this in 1864. I have not taken one back step since the light from heaven upon this subject first shone upon my pathway. I broke away from everything at once, meat and butter and from three meals. And that while engaged in exhaustive brain labor, writing from early morning till sundown. I came down to two meals a day without changing my labor. Exhausting labor. And yet she came from three meals down to two. How long did it take her? She said she did it when? At once. That's right. She did it at once. And that's the way I believe that people can. And sometimes people say, well, you know, the diet reform is supposed to be progressive. Yes, that's right. And then they may inquire, how long did it take you? And speaking of myself, and I may give my own personal experience. And sometimes I inquire, how long have you been trying? And sometimes I hear, well, we started leaving off meat in 1950, and they still haven't completed the reform yet. So when people ask me how many days it takes you to leave off meat, the answer to that is about 5 days. And you should by that time be completely over any faint feeling that you might have from leaving off meat. So I don't feel that people need to spend years and years and years getting off meat, and then years and years more getting off milk, and years more getting off sweets and butter and things like that. I feel that the changes could be made much faster. And in my experience, the changes can be made as fast as you can get new recipes. That was the limiting factor in our kitchen. As soon as we got new recipes and we knew what to serve, we were ready to serve it. And in my family, we have such good appetites anyway that when something new was introduced, we took it with relish. And if we didn't, there is a good thing that we can learn from something that Ellen White said here. She said, I suffered from keen hunger. I was a great meat eater. But when faint, I placed my arms across my stomach and I said, I will not taste a morsel. I will eat simple food or I will not eat at all. Bread was distasteful to me. I could seldom eat a piece as large as a dollar. Some things, for those of you who don't know, that's about an inch and a quarter, I guess, across. Some things in the reform I could get along with very well, but when I came to bread, I was especially set against it. When I had made these changes, I had a special battle to fight. The first two or three meals, I could not eat. Listen to this conversation. I said to my stomach, quote, you may wait until you can eat bread. In a little while, I could eat bread and graham bread too. This I could not eat before, but now it tastes good and I have no loss of appetite. I like that little conversation with the stomach. Well, some of us need to do that same thing. Our diet reform should be made consulting principle, not consulting taste. And if you will make your reforms consulting principle and not consulting taste, you will find that it isn't long at all that your tastes will begin to change, and you will begin to relish those things that you think you have no appetite for at all. I can count just many things that before we began to be careful with our diet, I had no relish for them at all, that now I like unusually well, like dates. I could never eat dates. They were very distasteful to me before we began a diet reform. And now I enjoy dates. They're very nice. I like to eat just plain dates. I had never eaten a whole date in all of my existence before that. And the same thing with olives. I didn't care for olives. Now I have to use great restraint in olives. And many other things that with diet reform, you find that your tastes enlarge and your appetites greatly increase. Now, the topic for today is diabetes and hypoglycemia. And I would like to direct your attention to Nutrition for Vegetarians, page 105, where we discuss this subject rather fully. And I'd like to bring out a few things that can be helpful in your dealing with people who have this disorder or in people who in whom the tendency to develop diabetes is present in their families. And first, I'd like to quote from Internal Medicine News for April 1-14, 1984, where they make this very sage comment. There are no safe, responsible snack foods for diabetics. Carrots and baked potatoes may generate blood sugar levels 80 to 90% as large as an equal serving of pure glucose. So what represents a safe, responsible snack for a diabetic? Nothing. That's right. A good drink of water is what the diabetic needs. Well, how about for me? I don't have diabetes. A good snack when I really have a good appetite between meals is fine for me, isn't it? No? Why do you not think so? Is there something special that makes you think that? All right, we have counsel that tells us that. We have counsel from the Lord that tells us, don't eat between meals. All right, we have some physiologic principles too. Where did they come from?
God made
those principles. And so naturally he would know about all those before he told the prophetess to give the church that counsel, didn't he? What else? What specific things do you... Yes?
Well, if you eat between, don't you get the gastric juices or, I don't know, something your stomach starts to get ready for a meal?
Oh, yes. Yes. And what is the most taxing thing, energy-using thing about eating a meal? Is it the muscular energy that you put forth in your arms and the chewing movements that you make with your jaws and all this muscular activity? What is it?
Digestion.
It's digestion. The chemical energy expended, or the energy expended as chemical energy to digest one meal, is as great an energy expenditure as 3 days of slave labor. So if you start up all of this activity in the middle of the afternoon, between meals, what is going to happen to your energy level? Sometimes people ask me to eat between meals. Or not very long ago, I was invited to go to an open house a couple of weeks ago. A friend of mine was They've been working for a couple of years at Fort Benning to open a great new building, and she was the head of the whole department of budget and finance at Fort Benning. She wanted me to go, and they were having a big shindig, and they were and going to have lots of things and put on a big spread of food. Won't you come? Yes, I'll be happy to come, but I can't come until 5 o'clock. She said, oh, the food will all be taken up by that time. And I said, well, that's just as well, because I haven't eaten between meals for years and years. So I wouldn't want to eat anyway, even if I did come when the food was there. But I'd love to see the flowers and like to see your new office, and I'd like to be shown around while the others are being shown around, and to celebrate with you while you're doing this. And I know you'll have a big glass of water for me, and I'd be happy to have that. So when I got there, we had all of these things that I just mentioned. All the food was still there, still out, and we got shown around, and then we were urged to eat. Well, why don't you eat? And I said, I don't have the energy to eat between meals. Well, that was very surprising. Just don't have any energy to waste along those lines. I have lots of energy, but just none to use in that area. Now, what is the glycemic index? Do you know what that is? Have you been studying and reading about that in health journals? The glycemic index is the area under the line in the glucose tolerance curve. So let's say here is the line that has to do with the levels of blood sugar, and here is the line that has to do on the bottom with the time. So let's say the blood sugar level goes something like this. Then we would draw a baseline right here, and then all of this area under the line that represents the blood sugar curve would be the glycemic index. Now you can see that somebody might have this kind of thing. Then only this quantity would be in the glycemic index. Or a diabetic might have this kind of curve, in which case all of this would also be in the glycemic index. So we are now understanding foods by the glycemic index that a food has. So a food, let's say a potato, has a certain glycemic index. The amount of area under the curve, the line, caused by the elevation of the blood sugar caused by that particular food. Now, there are certain things that have surprising glycemic indices. Things like orange juice has a surprisingly high glycemic index. And a potato has a surprisingly high glycemic index. About the same as an apple. And people are accustomed to thinking of potatoes as being good diabetic foods, and apples as maybe not being so good, or bananas. But actually, one may be about as good as the other. A sweet potato has half the glycemic index of a white potato. So just the very backward of what you might think that they would have. Notice this. Lentils, kidney beans, fructose, peanuts have 10 to 29% glycemic index. Whole grains, pastas, and cereals and so forth are 10. So are fresh fruits and vegetables compared to juices and purees and cooked vegetables. So we can see that there are some surprising things. We can feel free to recommend to diabetics that they take certain things that we have not felt that they could eat in the past. Now, let's define diabetes. It is literally the production of sugar in the urine caused by a high level of sugar in the blood. And it can very properly be paraphrased as accelerated aging. And those who have diabetes should take measures to try to control the diabetes and even to reverse it if at all possible. There are at least 5 million people in the United States who are diagnosed as having diabetes. And there are probably twice that number who are as yet undiagnosed. The disease is increasing and has been increasing over the past several decades, so much that we have now what we might call a diabetes explosion. Diabetes is of two different types, the adult onset type and the juvenile type. Juvenile type is called type 1, and the maturity onset diabetes is the type 2. And you will hear it more referred to nowadays as type 1 and type 2 than as juvenile and adult diabetes. Now, the adult diabetes is almost always associated with being overweight. And the juvenile diabetes is very difficult to control, so that most of the fluctuations that are big, the very high levels and the very low levels, and the insulin reactions and the brittle diabetics that you hear about, these are most of the time in the juvenile diabetics and not in the adult onset group. Yes. No, the reverse. Juvenile is not generally associated with, or need not be. Now, the diabetes syndrome generally starts even in the adult onset person, as or may, with the three things that you have heard of all your life. No question about it that it usually starts that way. What are those three? Polydipsia, polyuria, and polyphagia. Haven't you heard about that all the time? No? What is polydipsia? What? Always drinking water. And what is polyphagia? Always eating. And what is polyuria? Passing lots of urine. Okay, so those are the three things that are the most likely symptoms in the person who has diabetes. Now, the young patient who has those things, you especially want to watch carefully. For the adult onset diabetic, they are not in a distress, although a correction should be made as soon as possible. But for a very small diabetic patient, they can die if they are not taken care of rather promptly. Now, the oral diabetic agents have sometimes been used for diabetics, especially the adult onset diabetics. These are such things as diabenese and a number of other agents that are given by mouth instead of giving insulin. They are as contraindicated as any other drug, since they do have serious side effects, blood vessel problems, and general weakening of the immune system and a variety of other things. And I believe that any patient who could be controlled on the anti-diabetic agents by mouth could be controlled by diet alone. And so just try to get the person who is taking some kind of oral agent onto a good program. Now, it's good for the diabetic, the adult-onset diabetic, to give them a fast of a few days, maybe about 2 or 3 days, or even up to 5. At Emory University, they did a very good study showing that diabetics fasted for 3 to 5 days and also taken abruptly off their insulin, that when they were, during the time that they were fasting, their blood sugars fell quite low, and then when they were started back eating again, they could usually be maintained on half their insulin dosage, even if they'd been taking 100 units or more, or none at all. Some diabetics, once you have fasted them a few days, they will never have to take insulin again if you handle their program properly. So you give them a diet then, a very low-calorie diet of maybe 1,000 to 1,200 or at most about 1,500 calories until they have lost weight. And we have found that kind of regimen very successful here. Apparently what happens is that the receptors for insulin are reset so that the insulin that the diabetic is producing becomes active in the person's cells again, and they can again take up the sugar because the insulin receptors are reset on the cells, the glucose receptor intake set for the diabetic. And that is the problem with the diabetic. It's not that the adult onset type. It is not that the adult onset diabetic has a lack of insulin. He may be producing more insulin than the person who juvenile diabetic is producing by maybe three or four times. So, or even than he himself produced before he got diabetes. But it is the cells being unable to utilize the sugar and the insulin that has caused the problem. Now, that's about diabetes, and I would like to tell you some national case histories. First, the Pima Indians. Pima Indians don't have diabetes in their native surroundings. But if you put those Indians on a reservation and give them the high carbohydrate, high refined carbohydrate diet, high fat diet that most Americans are accustomed to receiving, these Indians will get diabetes in almost 50% of instances. An enormous increase, an enormous experiment in national experiment in diabetes. By the way, they usually also have much less exercise than they're accustomed to, and they tend to get fatter in the reservation than they do in their usual surroundings. Now the next one is the next study is on the Yemenite Jews. In the Yemen, Jews have hardly any diabetes. It is rare among them. But you give them the Western style of diet, such as they get in Israel, and again, almost 50% of them develop diabetes. It's a very interesting phenomenon, going from no diabetes at all on their natural diet, high in whole grains and fruits and vegetables, to about 50% of the population having it on the Western diet. They had almost no diabetes recorded 3 decades ago, and now they have lots of diabetes. Now the third study is that of the Eskimos. Eskimos had no diabetes prior to about 1950. And in 1950, shortly after 1950, I think it was 53, the Alcan Highway went through and took sugar along with it and added that to an already very high fat diet. And so these individuals now have diabetes as frequently as do people living on the mainland. So that's another national study showing the influence of a change in diet on those individuals who are involved in this. As you may know, Eskimos do not have acne, gallbladder disease, heart disease, or diabetes until 1953. And then they started having all of these just about as frequently as do people on the mainland. Gallbladder disease was a very interesting thing because most of the gastroenterologists who had studied the Eskimos felt that fat had nothing to do with the development of gallbladder disease because none of the Eskimos had gallbladder disease, and they had about 70% of their food in the form of fats. But just add a little sugar to, or a lot of sugar, to a high-fat diet, and that will bring on a lot of problems. Carious teeth, acne, diabetes, coronary heart disease, and gastrointestinal disease, along with some other things that are thrown in. Now, the complications of diabetes, you're probably also familiar with these. These complications are principally having to do with reduced healing and also with blood vessel problems. These blood vessel problems can involve the eyes, the gastrointestinal tract, the brain, the heart, the kidneys, the liver, the legs. And in all these areas, the diabetic can have such serious problems that they may lose the function of that particular organ. The eyes, the person may go blind. The legs may develop gangrene and have to be amputated. They may lose their ability to think because of the constriction of blood flow to the brain. And coronary heart attacks are, of course, a very common cause of death among diabetics. So it is well worth one's while to help the person who has diabetes to get rid of his diabetic condition. Now let's go briefly to the subject of hypoglycemia. And I'd like to just bring up the classic syndrome of hypoglycemia. It is that of beginning in infancy with such things as frequent colds and sore throats and earaches and colic, then progressing in childhood through carious teeth and appendicitis, and maybe getting a little overweight at some time. Now, none of these things that I have mentioned is essential to the diagnosis, but any one of them may be present, or all of them may be present in any one person. Then about the time they get to be adolescents, they start getting blue periods from time to time. These gloomy periods may be associated with a feeling of worthlessness, or even in some instances, a suicide attempt. When the young lady gets married, she often gains 40 to 50 pounds during a pregnancy and may have gained 15 or 20 pounds before her pregnancy begins. She is usually a very talented young lady who has done well in school, has been in everything, has been one of the outstanding scholars in the school, and has been a very prominent individual. Because of the fact that they mature earlier than usual, menstrual periods generally start at the age of 10 or 11 or 12, because of this early sexual development, they often want mature features of their lives, like getting a job and buying a car, getting a home of their own, and moving out from their parents' home. And so school dropouts are very common among those with a hypoglycemic syndrome. And the depressions may be so bad as to require psychiatric consultation for these individuals. And the time finally comes when when their lives are they're just not feeling well at all. Their lives are very poor quality. They may be unable to engage in those things that they formerly could engage in with diligence, and now they have no interest in it at all. And even if they did have an interest, they don't have the energy. Most of the time, they have an all-gone feeling and don't really know what to do with themselves. And sometimes they begin to have bizarre thoughts. They may think such strange things as, what would happen if I jumped in front of the train? Or what would happen if I robbed the bank when I go down to deposit the money? And just very strange thoughts. And if these thoughts are communicated to anyone, then the husband of such a person is very likely to say, when the physician says, I find nothing wrong with your wife, she's in optimal health, what she needs is a visit to the psychiatrist. Well, he begins to think that probably the physician is correct, and so he suggests to his wife that they see the psychiatrist. And a number of hospitalizations for mental and emotional discomforts and dysfunctions may follow. And the life is of poor quality and may be ruined by a diet-related problem. A diet-related problem that could be very easily corrected if people but knew how to do it. Now, we have had several cases that have been just as severe as the one that I have just mentioned to you and have had a very good outcome with proper care. And in our book, Nutrition for Vegetarians, beginning on page 112, you will find a section on how to go about the treatment for diabetes and the hypoglycemic syndrome. Actually, it begins on page 111. And it tells the foods that are allowed, the foods to avoid, and the general lifestyle of the individual with diabetes and hypoglycemia. And you will find all of this very helpful to you. Now, there are some questions that we often hear concerning the diabetic or hypoglycemic syndrome, and I'd just like to bring up some of these questions. The first one is there a way to have palatable soy milk without buying the commercial product? The commercial product is often impossible for the individual with the hypoglycemic syndrome or diabetes to use because of the sugar content in it. And yes, there are recipes for making soy milk if you particularly like soy milk that are quite delicious without using any sugar, and you can find recipes for that. We have some recipes in our cookbook, Eat for Strength, for such things as soy milk and soy cottage cheese and scrambled tofu that you make yourself from the ground up, and a number of other dairy products. These may use soybeans or nuts or cereal products, and you can quite easily make those. Here's another question. What is wrong if soy milk causes gas? Some people are very sensitive to soy products and will make gas from even the very faintest quantity of soy milk. Even a teaspoonful will make them produce a large quantity of gas. So we have to recognize some people's limitations and simply not use soy if they have a problem there. The things that can cause gas, the various foods that can cause gas, we have in the little syllabus that I think you were given called Health Emphasis Seminar Syllabus. Here's another question. Is the small amount of sugar in soyonnaise made from soyagen all right for the diabetic to use? And the answer is yes. In most cases, for diabetes, it will be, but for the person who is sensitive to sugar, they won't be able to take any. Next question is, how long must the diet be continued? And the answer to that is, as long as the disease continues to be active. Now, for some people, they can recover, maybe in a matter of a few weeks. For others, it takes a few years. And for others, it takes decades to recover. And during all of that time, they must be quite careful with the diet. Now, I don't know if there are any questions that you have from the floor about diabetes or hypoglycemia. I'd be happy to have them. One that I often hear is, can the diabetic have lots of coffee to make sure that it cuts down on the appetite so that they don't eat a lot of caloric foods? And the answer is no. Coffee is essentially bad for the diabetic and therefore should just be eliminated from the diet of the diabetic. The caffeine is bad for the pancreas. And the other substances in coffee, tea, colas, and chocolate are all deleterious to the health of the person with diabetes. Question?
Yes, I was wondering,
all right, the question is, what tests do we use to detect diabetes? The ones that I like the most are, number one, do a fasting blood sugar. And number two, do a two-hour postprandial blood sugar. Now, that's 2 hours after the person has begun eating their meal. So they should begin eating the meal and then right away start timing. One more question, I believe. Yes?
If one exhibits the signs of
polyuria, polydipsia, and polyphagia.
As a child, they're not exhibiting as an adult. Does that mean that they're no longer diabetic?
It probably means that they didn't have diabetes. If they developed these as children and didn't go on to a full-blown case of diabetes that mandated the diagnosis of diabetes, these children will die if they're not recognized and treated, then it probably means that they didn't actually have diabetes in childhood, but had some other condition that resulted in that. And then it could, of course, go away as that condition goes away, whereas juvenile diabetes does not go away. Yes?
Much about juvenile diabetes.
Uh-huh.
How do you treat it as compared to the adult?
All right. That's a good question. Juvenile diabetes must be treated with insulin and must be treated forever. You must not fast a person with juvenile diabetes.
They have it all their lives?
They will have it all their lives.
And the indicators on that are also the drinking all the time, eating all the time.
Mm-hmm. In fact, the classic signs are in relation to juvenile diabetes, polydipsia, polyuria.
Are those indicators as well?
They are indicators, not so clear in adults.
But more like overweight?
Overweight in the adult, whereas the child diabetic may actually lose weight. They may lose a lot of weight, and that immediately with the onset of the disease.
This has been another special American Cassette Ministers presentation featuring Dr. Agatha Thrash, co-founder of UC Pines Institute in Seal, Alabama. International copyright 1988, American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. Duplication or transcription in any form is prohibited. For additional copies of this cassette, please write to American Cassette Ministries, Post Office Box 922, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, 17108. If you have received a special blessing from this cassette, please tell a friend about your friend, American Cassette Ministry. We're a nonprofit corporation helping prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ.